Hello, everybody. All very welcome here today, as Aisling has outlined, for Space for All Towards Inclusive Practice. Today, I just want to set out before we begin, just, I suppose, the kind of atmosphere and environment we want to have in the room. We want everybody to feel comfortable. If anybody needs to move around, to stim, to get up and you know, be how you need to be or want to be in the space, we'd very much like to welcome that and invite that. I suppose we don't want to make any assumptions about any needs or comfort levels in the room as well. So with that in mind, we won't have the slideshow on throughout. It will come on when there's something that something that we need to show. Otherwise, it will be off. We'd also like to welcome our two ISL interpreters here today. We have Ciara Flatley and Ciara O'Connell, who will be signing for the event today. And they're very, very welcome to be here. Also, I suppose with inclusion in mind, for the purposes of anyone who might be blind or low vision in the audience, we will describe ourselves. We'll also try to describe any images that you'll see on the screen as well. But please do feel free if there's anything you want to interrupt us at any point, or if there's anything that you'd like us to do throughout the panel, feel free to let us know. But please do be comfortable within the space. Again, from the outset, it's also important to set out that this is a point of change. We're evolving, learning all the time. We're all here to learn and understand each other's needs and positions. We all have needs. And I suppose the idea is that we're looking at systems and infrastructure and kind of how we can create a more inclusive environment in what we're doing. We have wonderful panelists here today who will speak more. I'll stop talking now. Who will speak more. So I'll without further ado, I'll just describe myself and then pass on to our first panelist. So I am a white woman with short brown hair. I'm wearing an autumnal coloured cardigan, which is brown with some hints of blue on it. And yeah, I'm trying not to be too nervous. So so I'm babbling. I will slow down and hand over to Petal Pilly, who will introduce herself and her company, Blue Teapot.
Hi, everybody. As Linda said, my name is Petal Pilly. I'm a white woman with blondish hair and white top and kind of pinky lilac-y tank top. I'm the artistic director of Blue Teapot Theatre Company here in Galway.
Hello, everyone. I'm Michael Hayes. I have brown hair and I have a blue hoodie on, and I work with Blue Teapot Theatre Company.
Hi, everyone. My name is Niall Cleary. I'm a middle-aged white man with glasses, and I'm wearing a blue jumper. And I am the director of Graffiti Theatre Company, which is in Cork. And I also have a stubbly beard, which is greying slowly. And most importantly, I work with Jodie from time to time.
My name is Jodie O'Neill. I'm a white woman in my 40s with light brownish shoulder length hair. I'm wearing a navy dress with a floral print. I'm a freelance writer and performer for theatre, film and television. I'm also autistic. I make a lot of work that focuses on inclusive practice in terms of performance and performers, audiences, providing access, and also investigating underexplored narratives and structures.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jess Rowell. I'm a white woman in my mid-30s. I have darkish brown hair, which is tied up. At the moment, I'm wearing a hairband, which is black. I have a light pink scarf on, which is kind of nice and soft and cozy. And I'm wearing a black jumper. I also have a festival lanyard on as well, with the Babero, which is red, white, and it says Jess Rowell artist on. So I'm an inclusive dance artist, a movement facilitator, and a maker of immersive dance experiences for young audiences with additional needs. I have brought Making Waves to this festival, and we're in our third day. So we had 2 days of schools workshops, and we just had our first day of performances today. So happy to be.
Thank you, Jess. And I suppose just to explain to the audience as well, I suppose the the panelists today represent everybody's working in kind of an inclusive way and developing projects, but are also working in different ways. So Blue Teapot has a company structure. Niall has a company in Cork and he's working with Jodie, who's an independent artist, and Jess is an independent artist, and her collaborator Brian McSweeney is an independent artist as well. So people are coming from different kind of support structures and from different places, which I think is important to kind of talk about as well. And Petal, maybe you'll kick off then on how Blue Teapot works and the structure that you work with.
Yeah, so Blue Teapot is about 27 years going now, and it started within Brothers of Charity Services here in Galway. So that's a disability kind of service provider. And it began with a small project that was really community-based and to give people with intellectual disabilities a creative outlet and also to explore some of the themes in their lives. And over the years, it's grown. So in 2009, it became its own limited company, charity, organisation. And we moved the company off-site from sort of being temporary within that service structure into a building in the centre of Galway, so that the identity was firmly an arts identity. And that was really critical, I think, for the growth of the company and for the identification of all of the participants. So today we have kind of three programme strands. We have the community theatre programme, which has two elements to it. One is for kind of youth and young people, and the other one is adults 18 plus to whenever. And that very much kind of maintains that lovely original ethos where it's a lot of fun, a lot of exploration, quite anarchic, which is wonderful, and a lot about just a kind of people discovering themselves through creativity. And we established a quite structured performing arts school, because when I came into Blue Teapot, there was nowhere for somebody with an intellectual disability to train or have an experience of a Lear Academy or any such thing. So we really found that people confused a lack of training and skill and an opportunity to explore with disability. And that was really evident at the beginning. So that was why that was established, basically to kind of level the playing field a little bit. And it's accredited, and we found that all of the people just loved to graduate and have a graduation like everybody else. So that's the performing arts school, which is going strong and has just expanded as well. And the third programme is our professional acting ensemble, of which Michael is one. And that's a group of actors who have the privilege of being an ensemble in today's artistic climate. And they create work for the main stages of Ireland and beyond. So that's sort of our company structure. Yeah, where we are.
It's a brilliant structure, and you can see why it evolved, why it was needed, and where I suppose where you're changing the face of things. And Michael, you might speak to us a little bit then about your experience of becoming a professional actor and how that happened, and I suppose how Blue Teapot played a role in that, in your development as a professional actor.
I've been in Blue Teapot since I think it's about 2008. And I love being an actor in Blue Teapot, and I love all the acting, and we used to do parades for St. Patrick's Day, but we don't do it now. And well before I started, I done a bit of acting when I was in school, and when I went to other centres, and then the last centre I was in before I joined Blue Teapot, I saw a kind of a leaflet on the table about Blue Teapot, and I was asked if I wanted to join, and I said I'd give it a go. So I had to go for an interview, and I did an interview with Petal. And that's how I managed to get into Blue Teapot, and I've been working with Blue Teapot ever since that.
And Michael, was there anything that you felt? I mean, before you found Blue Teapot, did you feel that there were obstacles or hurdles kind of stopping you from pursuing what you wanted to do?
I don't think so. I did have a lot of acting experience.
Yeah.
I did other acting in plays when I was in school, and then in other centres. And
so yeah. Blue Teapot were lucky to find you, I guess.
Definitely.
and Michael, is there anything else then in terms of the support and the support you get from Blue Teapot to work as an actor? How would you describe that for you as an actor, how it helps?
Well, Blue Teapot have helped me a lot during my time there. When we're going out to doing our plays outside of Blue Teapot, and we went to other countries as well, and it's good to be going outside of Blue Teapot to show other people what we can do as well.
Brilliant. And that's an interesting point to make as well about kind of the touring and going out, yeah. Isn't it? And Petal, you were just telling me about a project that you're developing next year that Michael will be involved in. Do you want to talk to us a little bit about?
Yeah. So Michael and the rest of the company, a couple of years ago, said they really wanted to create work for children. So yeah. We listened, we heard, and we've just been successful with our arts grant application.
Yes.
So we'll be producing a theatre show for children called The Fairy Tree, and Michael will be part of that. But one of the lovely developments with it is all the actors wanted to train in facilitating theatre workshops to children, and they really articulated that very strongly. So they've been working with Lally Morris to basically learn facilitation of children, and that will work here in Galway and then go on the road around the county as well. So excited about that.
Yep.
Brilliant. Yeah.
It sounds great. And Niall, do you want to tell us a little bit about the project that yourself and Jodie are working on, and a bit about graffiti as well, where you're at?
Sure, yeah. And Petal, and Michael, I love the sound of that project. You mentioned it on a Zoom call a couple of weeks ago, and I think it's just so exciting. And like, I've been knocking around Galway for years on and off, but like Blue Teapot's always breaking ground, and it's just incredible. The work is incredible. So I'm the director of graffiti, as I said, and we're based in Cork in a theatre that isn't too dissimilar to this one. And the company has been around for about 40 years. Next year, it's 40 years. I haven't been there for the 40 years. I don't have that much grey in my beard. But a wonderful woman called Emily Fitzgibbon started the company and ran it up until about 5 years ago. And another person who broke ground and was making theatre for young audiences when it just wasn't a thing that you did. And I think things change so much, but I think, you know, working in the sector that we are of making work for young audiences, we are making work for underrepresented citizens a lot of the time. And I think that's just really, really important to remember, because we take it for granted because we're all in the sector. But it's always the battle, isn't it, to prove the worth and the value of the work. And it is so valuable. So graffiti we do a couple of things. We make work for young audiences. A lot of our work is made for children in our community in Blackpool in the north of Cork City, which is quite a disadvantaged area. It's an area that could do with a hug, I would say, and some brightening up. And it's been the company's tradition to bring work into schools and make work for the children who otherwise wouldn't normally go to see work because it's not part of their everyday lives. So that's a huge part of what we do. And one of the reasons we get out of bed is to make work for those, for that community. Another thing that we do, we run an early years program, again, for very underserved citizens between the ages of birth and 3. And when we're making that work, we're bringing it to creches and childcare centres. And again, to typically probably to children who wouldn't get to see this work otherwise. And we'd work with the traveller visibility groups in Cork, and unfortunately, direct provision is still a thing. So we work in direct provision settings as well. And that's quite a multidisciplinary programme. And we also have a youth theatre, and that's a really important part of what we do. And there are about 100 young people in the youth theatre who come to Graffiti every week. And unfortunately, there's about another 100 or so on a waiting list. But it's a really, really important part of our work. And I suppose the conversation that we're having is around inclusion, and that is the meaning and understanding of that has changed for me a lot in the last couple of years, and is continuing to change and continuing to learn about what inclusion is. And I suppose a couple of years ago in Graffiti, we'd talk about inclusion being working in Desh schools and disadvantaged areas. But of course, the conversation has evolved so much, and inclusion means so much more now. Segueing into Jodie a little bit, Jodie would have been a member of the youth theatre Fado, and I've been interested in Jodie's work for years as a performer and as a writer and as an activist. And a couple of years ago then, we ran a playwriting program with Babaro and with the wonderful Finnegan Crookemeyer in Australia. And Jodie was a participant on that program and began to write this beautiful piece called Grace, about a young girl who is non-speaking. And so we've set about producing and that work together. And then the doors open again into the learning that you need to undertake to create an accessible piece for performer and for audience. So that's the, I suppose that's an introduction to Graffiti and to the work that we're doing with Jodie at the moment.
Perfect. And Jodie, do you want to talk to us a little bit about that project? I guess listening to Niall there, it's interesting to hear about, I suppose, representation and perspective and visibility and your understanding of inclusion. And, you know, that is changing for everybody. And it does depend on your lived experience and where you're coming from. And like, you know, you think you understand one aspect and what it means, but then you're looking at it from your own perspective. So be interested to hear about how you're approaching, Jodie, your work and the piece that you're making with Graffiti.
Yeah, I think, like, I mean, yeah, Niall's right. Inclusion is a massive word, and it kind of isn't big enough to encompass all the things that need to fit under its, like, not big enough umbrella. And as Eleanor Walsh, I think, said I made a show called What I Don't Know About Autism, which kind of brought me into this world, I guess. But she was like, we don't even have women right yet. So we're not there yet. But it's amazing that there's lots of really exciting work happening in pockets, and then also really exciting when we can come together as a community to talk about it and to ask questions and to see what we're not doing right and what we are doing right. But I suppose to give a little bit of context for Grace, I guess in 2019, 2020, I wrote a play called What I Don't Know About Autism, which the idea of that show was to promote autism acceptance rather than awareness, because we all know about it, but we don't all embrace it, and to celebrate autistic identity. So I kind of set out to make a show with no idea how to make it, but that could be a welcoming space for autistic people, or for people who were interested in autism, or for people who just wanted to go to the theatre and have an enjoyable experience. And during the kind of very early research for that piece, something that came from a lot of parents and self-advocates was that there was very little portrayal of non-speaking autistic people in theatre, on screen, and in the media generally. And then when it was in the media, it was generally a narrative of tragedy and of struggle and of, you know, if only this person had words in the way that I have words, instead of if only I could enter and be invited into the inner life of this person so that we could have an exchange. So when we started the workshops, and I don't think I meant to write that play during the workshops, but I think we tried to show in What I Don't Know About Autism, we were trying to do a lot. So we were trying to tell the whole story of autism in 26 scenes. And so we touched on characters who would have been non-speaking, but it wasn't something that we could give a huge amount of like exploration time to. So it was something that was in my head. And then when we started the workshops, this character was emerging, who was called Grace, who is non-speaking. And I guess we're going to talk a little bit more about it tomorrow, but roughly the idea is that she has an incredible non-speaking relationship with her father. But when her father is no longer available to her, she has to find a way to communicate with her mother. And it's about them learning how to be together without spoken words. Is that...
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. And I've never quoted a person sitting beside me, Jody, so I might take the opportunity to do it now.
And then I'll quote you.
Yeah. We'll do it for about half an hour. I love Jody's piece, What I Don't Know About Autism, but there's an amazing line in it. If you've met one person with autism, then you've met one person with autism.
That's not even me, that's Stephen Shore.
Oh, no!
It's good to say it is Dr. Stephen Shore, who's also like an amazing autism advocate, but it is in the play.
And Jodie also said it in the play.
Yeah, that's true. And I think we don't realize when we kind of live on the periphery of having an awareness of the kind of myriad conditions of being a human, of the fact that... We like to label things. We like everything to be neat. We like to pin, okay, oh, I know what autistic is, when actually I still have no idea what autistic is. I wake up in the morning and I'm new to myself. and then I meet other people who share that label, but have completely different experience to me. So
it's true. It was said earlier on when we were talking about we're individuals, we're all individuals. So there isn't kind of that's it, isn't it? It's like we are all individuals. So there isn't a shared, like there's commonalities, but there isn't nobody's the same either, which is interesting to kind of consider that too. Brilliant. Jess, do you want to tell us a little bit about what your practice involves?
Yeah, just going back then to 2009, I started working with Trace of Dance Ensemble, which is a company based in Waterford for disabled dancers. So that was where my interest was kind of, my heart, I suppose, was captured. I felt like I'd come home to something that was very familiar to me, working in a very... open, like creating open dialogues and creating work together, as opposed to, you know, making a piece of work and saying, okay, this is the work, now we're going to learn, you know. So it's devised, and so it felt familiar, it felt like coming home. And I spent 10 years with Trace's Dance Ensemble, and there was a dance artist in the company, Brian, who Linda's already mentioned, and we formed a really strong movement connection, and we went on to developed some duets and performances and really enjoyed our process together over a 10-year period. We grew together. And then I was invited to DRIACT, DRIACT Blanchardstown, which is an arts centre in Blanchardstown in Dublin, I was invited as the dance artist in residence. So I had a 3-year residency there. And Brian featured very heavily. So he came with me into the residency. He was still based in Waterford, but we accommodated and brought him up throughout the various projects that I ran. But also he facilitated. So he co-facilitated, I mentored him, and it was a really enriching experience and process for the two of us. It was one piece in particular now that I'll go on to, which is Making Waves. He wasn't part of the development of that. And that was because it was my first time and my first venture into making work for young audiences with additional needs. So I needed time to kind of dig into that and really understand it before I could bring him into any of this, that type of work. So at the moment, what we're looking at is the steps and the stages needed to bring Brian into a piece of work for young people with additional needs. So it's probably the right time now to introduce Brian on screen.
We see text come up on screen. Brian McSweeney, dance artist. Brian McSweeney is a dance artist with Down syndrome based in Waterford, Ireland. He has been dancing for over 14 years and is a founding member of Trace's Dance Ensemble. Most recently, Brian has worked with inclusive dance artist Jess Rao during her 3-year dance residency at DRIACT Blanchardstown, 2020 to 2022. So we now see a series of photos of Brian's previous performance experience. The first one is Voices from 2022, an integrated dance performance choreographed by Jess Rao, Hayley Erlem, and filmed by Christian Mantelvanis in Druid, Blanchardstown. The second photo we see is Trace's Dance Ensemble, an image of Brian dancing in 2010. And then the final photo we see is a series of images from Ripples, which is an inclusive dance film choreographed by Jess Rao and filmed by Christian Mantelvanis, again in Druid, Blanchardstown. The next slide we see is a text slide, and it reads, Brian and Jess are currently working together to research and identify the essential access supports needed in order for them to continue to develop their professional working relationship post Jess's residency. And then we move into the video. We see young disabled children entering into a school hall with their teachers. Everybody's smiling and the children are clapping as they walk in the door. The children we see on screen are wheelchair users, and they're with their teachers as they walk into a brightly lit room full of blue tones and blue fabric. Brian and Jess are standing in the center of the room and they're welcoming the young students with open faces and smiles. Everybody settles in and we see an image of Brian McSweeney, dance artist, in the center of the room preparing the session. So it's a workshop setup. Young children with disabilities are seated in their wheelchairs and also on small chairs and benches in the room with their teachers. And the next shot we see is Brian McSweeney interacting with the dancers with some soft, colourful scarves, which he's moving in the air. The children are responding and also moving with scarves. Brian speaks. Jess and Brian are playing with long pieces of fabric, which is moving the air in the space. So the children are really enjoying the experience of moving and swaying in the breeze. They're also using light foil fabric, which moves and makes a crinkling sound as it moves in the space. This also catches the air and floats above people's heads, and it's all very exciting. Brian and Jess are dancing in the space and encouraging the young people to move and sway. There's lots of smiles, and everybody looks like they're having a great time. We now cut to text on screen. The footage of this clip was captured by Christian Mantelvanis during a week of research and sensory dance training Brian participated in with Jess Rao, mentor Libby Seward, and students in St. Catherine's Special School, County Wicklow. The making of this video was supported by Mehl, a Branagh initiative.
And I'd just like to say that Brian is represented via that video because movement is his most comfortable way of communication, and we wanted his voice to be included in the panel today. And what we've just seen there was some video footage of how Brian and Jess worked together in a school setting. So there was dancing and movement and Brian's involvement in a project with Jess, which was a research and development project, a week that you had recently, Jess, wasn't it? With a view to making inclusive...
A new piece, yeah. So this is the foundation, I guess. We were talking about how things take so much time and allowing space for things to evolve and to discover. So for Brian, stepping into a project like this, it would be his first experience of working in that particular way. So starting at the beginning, I mean, this, what you see here, isn't going to be, it probably, that won't end up in the final piece, for instance. It's just, it's a base level training, a way in of seeing how Brian feels in a space, in a school setting like this, and working that closely and intimately with young students, and whether it suited him. So he was interested and said, absolutely, I'd really like to be part of that week of research, but whether he actually, you know, you have to go there, you have to experience it to know whether it's something that you really, really want to be a part of. And so it was a really positive experience. And I think that, you know, we've laid the foundations now, and we've also really, we've sat and evaluated after the week to see what types of supports Brian would need going forward to for him to be part of our next piece of work. So yeah, it was a great experience.
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting thing for us to consider, I suppose, in wanting Brian to be part of the panel today. This was the way that we found for that to happen, but there's a lot of talk about, I suppose, ways of working together, the structures, the infrastructure, what the support needs are, how we can find those new ways of working in order to make sure that people can be included and represented and their voices heard as well. And I think it's brilliant. The work that everybody's doing here is kind of moving towards that and exploring kind of ways of moving towards inclusive practice and considering how do we work? How can we work, and what are the options to make sure that we keep moving things forward? And it's interesting, Jess. I mean, we've talked about this as well. Support structures for independent artists and for companies are challenging anyway. And then when there are more supports that you need, and look at with different ways of working in the absence of an infrastructure, that can be even more challenging. And Petal, I'm sure even in terms of Blue Teapot, there's challenges for company structures and graffiti the same. I mean, Niall, you've spoken about the needs to develop, like the timing need, the funding needed to develop these things. And maybe we'll speak a bit about that aspect of inclusive practice as well.
We talk about money.
Let's talk about money. The floor is yours, Niall. The floor is yours. I was dancing around it, but let's go.
It's just a reality of making work, isn't it? Work costs money, and good work costs money. And when you're making work that is more inclusive, and I'm just kind of getting in there now, and you've so much more experience than I do at this point, but so, I suppose speaking to this part of the journey, if you want work of that quality, perhaps you need a longer rehearsal period. Perhaps you need shorter days. Perhaps you need more people in the room. Mm-hmm. Like today we have two interpreters doing brilliant work, and that's two more people that we should have, but we also need the budget for two more people. And if you want to maybe sleep somewhere, you might need accommodation and you might need a hotel room, and all of these things add up, and they're all important. And so to make the work, to value the work, you've got to pay for the work for it to reach the standard that it needs to reach. And there are more access costs, and we budget access costs, and we don't necessarily get those budgets, and then the work suffers and the work becomes less than you want the work to be. And it's a shame when that happens. So like it's something that, yeah, it's something that we need to talk about, those access costs, where they come from. Mark, I'll quote you now, and maybe you didn't say this either. But yeah, you know, when you're making work for young audiences, the hotel room is the same price as the work for mainstream audiences. And when you're making work that is accessible, you need more people on the ground to deliver that work, and all of those people need to be paid according to their profession and the value of their work and their expertise.
And certainly we're kind of finding through like Bronner's work with Mehel as well, there's 16 artists and producers working independently on board, and you see how much the weight of expectation is carried by independent artists as well as companies to try and make that happen with very limited kind of resources. So it certainly is something that needs to be talked about more and kind of way.
And to not be afraid of asking. We talked about that on the Zoom call. We do feel at times it's like, oh, I could cut that there, I could cut this here, I could slash that, you know, because you're afraid of the big figure at the end.
And you're cutting the value
you're saying,
of the
well,
work
actually,
as you do
why?
It.
And also, I guess, putting a value on work by disabled artists and for disabled artists, because at the moment, if you look kind of across the board at funding opportunities, if you're doing something that involves arts participation, if you're doing something that often involves young people, or if you're doing something and maybe identify as a disabled artist, the money that you can access is less rather than more. So typically you're trying to do more with a lot less capacity. And I think maybe you talked a little bit about this, Jess, on the call, but the kind of idea of responsibility as an independent artist. So you meet artists and maybe you're at a different point in your career. So I would kind of identify, I guess, as mid-career, but I meet early career artists who have the capacity to be professional artists, but I meet them at a project and it's a limited amount of funding for that project. And I have to pay my rent and then I have to go at the end of it. And yet I can think of like three people at the moment in my head who I carry around with me all the time, thinking I need to get the money for that person to publish their book. I need to get the money for that person to do their set design mentorship. I need to get the money for this. And yet there's only, and when I went and spoke with an arts officer about this issue, they were like, well, it's not really your problem, is it? You can't take that on board. I'm like, but I already have, like, I really like that person. I really want to hang out with them. So I think that's a huge issue, is that, you know, when you're not connected into a company and you're not kind of on a salaried basis, and also that person might be in a, within a service, so it might be harder to access direct communication with them anyway. Then that becomes just a kind of a huge weight of guilt and a huge loss, actually, to the arts industry, that we don't have those people now making their work, and we're not seeing their work because nobody is supporting them.
And that's an important point, isn't it? Because pathways, it's you're supporting and finding pathways for people to develop their career. But if you're going to hit a brick wall at every, you know, once you get to the end of a project, or once you kind of, a professional gets to a point where they need to step forward again, if there's a brick wall there and you can't kind of develop further, that stunts growth and it stops kind of the inclusive process from flourishing, whether no matter what stage of a career you're at, really.
Just in complete agreement with you, and that's exactly what happened at the end of the 3-year residency, was that I went into a place of, okay, now I really need to establish myself as an independent artist without the infrastructure around me of that residency and the support, the financial support, and the support for Brian was literally just went pachum. And it all came onto me. And I just, I needed time to figure it out. And luckily I did have the support of Mehl. That's been an amazing support over the last 2 years or year and a half. But now we're kind of putting things, the wheels are in motion again, you know, and it feels good. But it was scary. And I did feel guilty for about a year where I went, oh, I've been able to give this level of support and now nothing.
And Petal, what's your experience?
Ditto, there's so much in all of those elements there. The first thing around the process of creating work and sort of giving all the right space and support to somebody's artistry and their own impulses to emerge are quite different. And even within our company, as you mentioned, Linda, they're all individuals, so they're not a blob. It's not a blob. They're an ensemble, but they're not a blob, and they're all quite different. That's a huge part of, you know, when I think about the way that Blue Teapot has grown, it is to try to buffer so much of what you've just spoken there. And in the beginning, it was, you know, more as 1 to 2 people, and we've grown as an organization. So the process is different, and timing is different, and absorption time. If our actors work with text, they need to work at a particular pace. We work 4 hours a day. Some of that is dictated by transport issues. So if somebody can't travel independently, which leads into funding, so when we might be preaching to the converted here, but in our early applications or trying to explain to people, well, actually, if these actors are going to take their work, which is wonderful and valuable and valued by audiences, and get on the road and you just go to Athlone, that's going to cost you a fortune, you know. And yeah, a couple of times I cleaned out our reserves and had a slap on the wrist afterwards, but the work wouldn't have got out before, you know. So that's how Sanctuary went to Dublin. If it didn't go to Dublin, it wouldn't have kept going and kept going and kept going. So, you know, it's getting better, but they're very real. We're approached by independent filmmakers and theatre makers. And when I get into the reality of he can't come to Dublin for a week without a person to be with him. And then they go, it's so real. So what, that opportunity doesn't happen for somebody. And you are talking about somebody's life, an opportunity, barriers to entry, and so that's very that's very real. And I think collectively within this country and abroad, things are changing and changing slowly. I completely relate to the guilt. We still feel guilty. We can't facilitate everyone within the company. But absolutely, there are projects and there are incredible impetuses that have come from artists. We brought Charlene's piece of work through to fruition, and that was a long, slow process, and we got good support for that. But there are other people within the company with phenomenal projects that are just there, and you're just like, okay. So, yeah, I can relate to all of it. Yeah.
Just something myself and Jodie were talking about during the week as well, is like, who makes the decisions, and how is disability or diversity represented on panels and decision making and application processes? So it's a big conversation. And the last person of the day that I'll quote, because I only know three people. It's Martin Drury. Martin founded the ARC, and I'm sure lots of people know him here. But policy isn't provision. Do you know? Yeah. And it's not. And we have lots of great policy around inclusion, but we don't have provision.
That seems like a good note to maybe open to the audience for questions. You know, we want to kind of have a conversation. So it would be good if anybody wants to throw anything to the panel. I wouldn't say at the panel, but or any comments that or experiences from the audience as well. It would be great to kind of to have a conversation, because we've talked about this loads. There are so many aspects that you could dive very deeply into within this conversation that we just don't have time for. But there, you could spend 24 hours, Petal, as you said, talking about it all. So it would be really nice just to touch on as much as we can, or just to hear what's of interest to people in the room as well. Just for the purposes of the podcast, I'll just quickly surmise April's question there. It's just about policy and quoting policy back to the funders so that they're very clear. I'm sorry, now I'm going to paraphrase, but so that it's clear that artists and creatives are helping to deliver on those policies and on those objectives. So Niall, I guess that's back to the provision piece of policy.
Well, thanks for the question. And I heard a loud ha in the audience. So that's my answer. during the application process, certainly quote policy and aligning your work to the policy in a way. You're not trying to create work to match the policy, but I don't think it does make a difference.
Yeah, it's tricky, isn't it? Because it really comes down a lot to empathy and a kind of a shared experience a lot of the time. And this is totally off the subject, but even within our school recently, there was an issue with workbooks where children were being expected to suddenly write in copybooks. And for some children, that was a hugely challenging thing. Mm-hmm. And so as a school, we tried to change the policy around that. But because people didn't have a direct experience of it within their household, it was very hard for them to understand. And I think that can be the same with when people sit down on a panel and there's not a disabled person, or there's not people of color, or there's not somebody who's grown up in like a different kind of socioeconomic circumstance. There's not somebody who's had experience of direct provision. It feels less relevant to them. So I think it's actually about the organizations themselves holding themselves accountable, because we can quote the policy all we want, but unless the people who are making the decisions on the day have that lived experience, or are being these are the priorities for this for this round, I don't think that it happens. I think that the ones that people fight for what they know in on those panels, and when I've been on them, that is a part of what happens. And also the applications that get to panel are the ones that are generally people who've been to college, who know how to put a sentence together, who have all the skills to do that and have been supported to do that, and also have the networking skills. So even the application processes themselves are already not fulfilling those policies.
Absolutely not.
Yeah. And that thing of the unknown unknowns comes up a lot. You know, Joanne Byrne says this all the time for Brenner. There is a lot of the unknown unknowns, and that's it. People will fight for what they know.
Yeah.
A couple of years ago in graffiti, we brought an inclusion officer on board as part of a capacity building, and it was great. And But the question is asked all the time now, who's in the room? Who are you talking to? Are you talking to yourself again here? You know, and very often decision makers, and I'd include myself in that in my small world, do you know, that you do end up talking to yourself unless you're challenged and unless you invite that challenge into the room and unless you really examine who you're actually serving, who you're actually working with, who's actually on your board, who are the artists in the room. But they're hard questions and you fall short all of the time, but they're really important questions to ask.
No, I think that's a really good note to end on, and just to thank Kira and Kira for interpreting for us today. We appreciate it. And thank you to everyone for being here and for listening and understanding, coming on a journey. And yeah, I thank you to the wonderful panelists and to Brian McSweeney as well, who is here with us through video. It's been really inspiring and great to hear the work everybody's doing and the experiences everybody has. And hopefully we'll continue to learn and to evolve and grow and kind of change the systems that help us all kind of to do things better. So thank you, Aislinn, for having us here today as well, to Fabro. And hope everyone has a good evening. Thank you.